Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Welcome to LSE for this hybrid event. My name's Professor Coretta Phillips, and I'm from the Department of Social Policy here at the LSE. And I work broadly in the field of race and crime. I'm really delighted to welcome back Professor Inse Koch, who is no longer a full-time member of faculty at LSE, but retains a strong association with the LSE. Welcome back. And also really pleased to hear that your book's now out and published in the prestigious Clarendon Studies in Criminology series, but is also importantly open access, so you don't have to pay the ridiculously high prices that Oxford University Press charge for their monographs. Welcome to all of you, and also welcome to our online audience. This event is being hosted by the International Inequalities Institute and also the LSE Law School. So I'm going to introduce all of our panelists in a moment. But first of all, just the usual housekeeping. Can everyone please turn their phones to silent so that we don't disrupt the event? The event's being recorded and will hopefully be made available as a podcast, subject to any technical difficulties. I want to offer thanks to Peter Kane, as ever, who's just super organised and brilliant at organising all of the logistics for the event. Lots of stuff going on behind the scenes, so thank you for doing that so brilliantly, as usual. If the fire alarm gets sounded, we have to move to the Sorswe POC building that's in old money, the new academic building. But hopefully there won't be a fire alarm. So just by way of introduction, and then I'll say just a bit about the format for tonight's event. So Professor Inse Koch is a writer, advocate, researcher, and professor at the University of St. Gallen in Switzerland, also visiting professor in the law school at LSE. You already know the title of tonight's event. The first person to organise the discussion will be Liz Fakiti, who's director of the brilliant, amazing Institute of Race Relations and also an advisory editor for Race and Class. We also have, to my immediate left, Kojo Chiriwa, who's founding member of Black Lives Matter UK, where he remains a national organiser. And Kojo is also founding member of Against Borders for Children. And then to Liz is left, right? Left.
Left.
Glody Wobila is a community advocate whose lived experience features very much centrally throughout the book. Glody was convicted under human trafficking legislation in a drugs-related case that was the first of its kind, made precedent in English law, and he'll be talking very much about his very negative experiences. Glody now is the creator and host of the Glow Talks podcast and a founder of Glow Fitness UK. So the format for tonight's event is essentially a discussion between our panellists, and occasionally I think I'll be possibly chipping in, but we have lots of really interesting questions and commentary, so that may not be possible. Towards the end, we'll have around 25 to 30 minutes for audience questions, and I'll come back to you and explain how we'll do that. So over to Liz to begin our conversation.
Thank you very much, Coretta. And before we begin the conversation, I'd just like to make a few introductory remarks and sort of contextualise why this meeting is so important, why this book launch is so important. Very privileged to know Insa. She's also an editorial working committee member of our journal Race and Class, and her first intervention with Patrick Williams, who I'm very pleased to see in the audience, and Lauren Rowe was in our journal. That's open access too. So please look at that if you can. So, cometh the hour, cometh the woman. Insa, can you concentrate, Pete? This is a book launch. This is your book launch. I mean, honestly, this woman, she's got concentrations bad. Right. She's rivers. Cometh the hour, cometh the woman. Which is as much to say, this book has landed just in the nick of time. This book was actually based on 5 years ethnographic research on working class estates. Insa observed 6 full-length trials. She shadowed law enforcement and lawyers and spent months on end with young people and their families, mostly mothers, labelled by the system as angry and overbearing. Black mothers labelled angry and overbearing? Does it sound familiar? So thanks to her, we have the communities of knowledge, bottom-up knowledge, survivors' knowledge of what's wrong with the state's top-down drugs enforcement wars. Tonight, our aim is to use this book to kickstart a debate that has the potential to change the whole terms of debate on the policing of county lines. So before I outline how we're going to structure the conversation, let's think about the wider context tonight and what we already know about the harms of the policing of drugs. We know, thanks to the bravery of Char Q and Black community advocacy around Char Q's case, we already know so much. A 15-year-old Black girl on her period was strip searched in school after teachers called police because they said she smelled of cannabis. We know, thanks to a recent report by the Children's Commissioner, that Black children are 8 times more likely to be strip searched than their white peers, with the vast majority of strip searches, 89%, carried out on suspicion of drugs. So the Met are under a lot of pressure to reform. Don't know if anyone's here from the Met tonight. Check the shoes. And yet they are doubling down on the hyper-militarised end of policing. Sir Mark Rowley is citing the lower life expectancy of young Black kids to say more needs to be done to protect kids from knife crime and drugs culture. In effect, what he's telling us is that an anti-racist police force is going to save the Black community from themselves. That's the kind of white saviourist nonsense that the book unpicks. So that's what we're going to discuss more in the conversation. But rather than white saviourism, what we need is to rebuild our communities. And as Insa and her collaborators are at pains to show, the hood economy is brutal. It exploits the outcasts, mostly children excluded from mainstream educational provision, marked out as for exploitation as runners. But it's lack of any economic stake in society that creates the conditions for recruitment. So let's listen to the survivors and their families. Let's stop thinking in terms of victims and perpetrators and start thinking of building on the knowledge of those who have survived the drugs economy and then survived jail. So let's move it on and start the conversation. And I'm going to turn to Glody and Insa to kick us off, talk a little bit about county lines and the drugs economy. So Insa, let's start at the beginning. How did you get interested? Why did you start this research?
Yeah. Why did I start this research? Sorry, I'm very nervous. I'm trying to talk calmly, so yeah, hopefully I'll make sense. So I started this research. So this is not, I guess, your traditional academic study whereby you come up with a research question, you read your theory, and then you sort of go out into the real world to find the data. Instead, the book is really based on the voices and struggles of mostly the mothers, the carers, the family members, and also the young men themselves who are at the heart of the book. And the project, I started thinking about these issues really back in 2016, 17. I'd gone back to a community that's very close to my heart. a multicultural working class estate I've been working with for a very long time now. And one of my closest collaborators there, a mother of three and a community activist, she was telling me about a case of a kid, local kid from the estate, who was known to the police as a drug dealer and who the police had now identified as a victim of criminal exploitation and trafficking. And that was the first time I heard, well, the police use this language of victimhood in relation to drugs runners or drug dealers. At that point, like I said, this is 2016-17, I'd been one of many academics and activists and people who'd been speaking out about and critiquing the war on gangs, right, that the government had initiated. And that was all about punishing drug dealers. And yet here we had the same institution, the same state, talking about these kids now potentially as victims. And it was really that shift that I wanted to understand better. And so I ended up doing, as you said, a four or five year long project whereby I really tried to understand the stories of these kids better, that, yeah, that the kids who are now being discovered as victims.
And how did you meet Clodagh?
And how did I meet Clodagh? I guess we kind of met. Well, we didn't really meet, but I knew about you from about 2019? 2019, yeah, when Clodagh, as Liz said earlier, Clodagh was part of a test case that the British government had brought to see if it could use modern slavery legislation to prosecute drug dealers for more than just a drugs trial, essentially for modern slavery offences or human trafficking offences. And I'd been given access to this trial through the prosecution, so that's how I was able to be there, and I followed the entire trial. But by that point, so 2019, I'd already been working with the mothers for, you know, a number of years. And I knew that whenever the state has a story about justice, right, and doing the right thing, there's always a more complicated story. And so I knew I didn't want to publish this book. I didn't want to do this research unless I was able to talk to you, really. Yeah. And we couldn't connect for years because he was locked up. You were locked up. And then we reconnected in, well, we connected for the first time probably in 2023.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And Clodagh,
a couple of years ago,
your knowledge, your lived experience features very, very strongly. It's spread throughout the book. And, you know, we want to learn from that. We're not here to judge. We were here to learn from you. So take us back through your story. I know you came to the UK from Congo, age 5. You grew up on a South London estate. Can you take us through those early years? And what led you into drug dealing at 14?
Hello everyone. I grew up in Lewisham, Forestall. I was born in Congo, arrived here 5 years old, and we didn't speak any English. My family, we didn't even know anything about England. You know, I don't know why my parents never done the research about the country, about the country that we was coming into. But, yeah, we just ended up here. You ended up on a road called Tyson Road. If anyone's heard of it, a small little road in Forestall with loads of estates. I'm the only boy of, at the time, I just had an older sister. I've got three sisters now, but at the time, it was just me and my older sister. My dad was always out working hard all the time. He was hardly in the house. So essentially, it was most of the time me, my mum, and my sister in the house. And as a young boy discovering where I am, I had loads of energy. My education wasn't good. I never went to school in Congo and things like that. So I started, where I lived, looking out my window was the estates. You know, I lived literally across the road and there's only one shop in that whole area. And I used to look out the window in the bedroom window that I shared with my mom, my sister and my dad. We all shared one room. And I used to look outside that bedroom window as a kid and I used to see the guys outside playing up, kicking ball, you know, pulling up in their cars, playing music, girls around, energy, atmosphere. A part of me wanted to be a part of that society. I wanted some friends. I never had friends. I never knew anyone here. Hardly had any family members that already lived here apart from the family I came with. So as I was getting older, I was getting more intrigued of what was going on outside of the house. You know, like I said, my dad was hardly in the house. So as a boy, my older sister, she's the complete opposite to me. Like, she's a bookworm. She's a geek. Like, you know, she's very smart.
Like Insta.
Yeah, I feel like Insta. So, I felt like I wasn't. I just didn't fit. You know, something was missing. I just didn't fit, and I started playing out more, kicking ball with the lads outside. You know, I was actually born cross-eyed. You might notice if I don't focus, but I had an operation done. So growing up, I was cross-eyed. Went to Fairlawn Primary School, and that school was also on the estate. So a lot of the guys that I used to see outside the window, they all went to that same school. So as I was going to school, went through bullying, of course. Kids can be cruel, you know. So people used to take the piss out of my eyes, my hair, my everything. I was like the poster boy for Congo, you know. My parents still lived, like we were still in Congo at home. You know, no one spoke English. My dad hardly spoke any English, even though he was here before us. And it was like a culture clash. Like when I was outside the house, I was in a whole different environment. And then when I came home, it was another environment. And sad to say, but my parents didn't understand the environment that was going on outside of the house. So it was very hard for me to even talk to them about what I was going through mentally, physically, outside of the house, because they were just like, go to school, you know, go to school, go to school. So eventually I stopped coming home and speaking to my parents about my issues, because they never really understood it well, you know. I never came from bullying in Congo and things like that, you know. So when I'm trying to explain to my parents, this kid's making fun of my eyes, they're just like, just go to school. Do you know what I mean?
So, Glody, did the people who recruited you into drugs, did they make you feel like they were your family, that they understood you? Is that how you got sucked in?
Later on, fast forward, I got kicked out. I left either or. I was smoking cannabis in my mom's house, and I was essentially homeless. You know, I was literally homeless. Like, I was sleeping on buses. I was sleeping on the estates. I was sofa surfing, whatever you want to call it. And then eventually I met a pal who said they could help me out, you know, help me get a roof over my head, help me make some money. You know, at that age, at 14 years old, I was thinking life can't get any worse, you know. So as I moved into this place that was offered to me to live in, the person who had the house said to me, look, don't worry about making money. I got someone else that can help you make money also. And I had to pay rent while I was staying. You know, he said, you got to look, mate, you got to pay me £50 a week, but don't worry about that, because I'm going to show you how to make the money. And I just ended up in Hastings. I got in a car, got taken to Hastings. I got shown what to do. I got shown what drugs. Before this, obviously I was smoking cannabis. I knew about cannabis. Local lads were selling cannabis, but I never knew nothing about Class A drugs. No one ever talked about Class A drugs on my estate. It wasn't a thing like that, you know. So when I went to Hastings, literally the first time I'm getting told what crack cocaine is, what heroin is, how to bag it up, what each piece sells for, make the money, the most important things, I'm getting everything told to me, you know. I saw it as an adventure. As a young boy, I was thinking like, wow, like, this is actually good. I'm in Hastings with a seafront. There's seagulls. There's an ice cream van. Like, this is lit, you know. So I wasn't worried at all. I wasn't concerned about anything. I was just like, okay, this is what I got to do. Boom, boom, boom. Because my goal was to make the money, you know. I'm getting paid at the time £500 a week is what I've been told my wages. So I'm doing the maths. I'm thinking, okay, if I can work a whole month, I'm going to have this amount of money, blah, blah, blah. Not knowing the dangers I was with or the environments I was in.
So that's the point. It all turned.
Yeah.
Seagulls weren't there anymore.
No,
16.
Yeah.
Sentence. I think, was it 16 when you were sentenced? Yes. To 3 years in
prison? So eventually the house that I was selling drugs from later on ended up getting raided. I got arrested for drugs concerning supply. The police just came in the house, kicked in the door. Obviously, I've been keeping up a bit of havoc before that, like running away from the police and nearly getting caught but missing them, all of that. So when they came into the house, they already knew that they were looking for me, arrested me. There was no question of my age. There was no anything. You know, they searched the house. They found the drugs. They put me in handcuffs. They were arresting me for concerning supplier. Went to court, got my solicitor. And I'm just, remember, this is all new to me. So I don't know what my rights are, what I'm entitled to. Am I a victim? Am I not a victim? This and that. I just know that I've been dealing drugs and I've been arrested. I got given 3 years at a young offenders institution at the age of 16. And you know, at the time, I thought my life was over. I cried so hard. I thought I was never coming home. You know, 3 years at the age of 16 felt like a lifetime, you know. And I went into jail. I went into Cook and Wood. And it's like I had to become a different person. I had to become what my environment was, you know. I easily adapt. I can adapt anywhere. You put me somewhere, I'm going to adapt to that environment. And that's exactly what it was like with Hastings. And that's exactly what it was like when I went to Cook and Wood, you know. Same kind of pattern in prison. I started fighting. I'm fighting prison officers. I'm fighting other prisoners, other gang members in Lewisham that I wasn't even aware of. But because of my area, now I'm aware that there's people from other areas that don't like my area. So now I'm involved in this whole gang beef, war turf in prison. And like I said, I'm a good fighter. Well, I didn't say, but I was a good fighter. You know, I would fight till the cows come home if I could, you know. And that was one of the things that also earned me respect when I was growing up on the estate. But yeah, prison, young offenders, I mean, there's not really much to learn in young offenders because it's like everybody is trying to figure themselves out also. And there's a lot of egos trying to figure out who they are. So then it becomes like a building full of young boys with testosterone that doesn't know how to walk away or say please or thank you or have the kind of, you know, mannerism that you think people would have. So yes. Young offenders turned me into more of a criminal, if I'm going to be honest with you. I felt like I'm amongst people that are advising me, they're telling me this, and I'm thinking, okay, so I got arrested. This is how I got arrested. So when I come out of prison, I now know what not to do. You know, I thought I was becoming a better in the craft, essentially. No one ever sat me down and said, did anyone use you to sell drugs? Was you a victim? These things never, ever popped up. So I always thought I was the main character, you know. I've been arrested with the drugs. I got arrested with the money and I'm the main character. No problem. I came out of prison at 18. Bearing in mind, I was homeless before I went into custody. Part of my bail conditions was to go back into my mum's house. And yeah, they downsized and obviously family connections broke down. So it wasn't as easy as just go back to your mum's house. You know, there was a lot of home complications at the time, which found it very difficult for me to get into my resettlement and whatnot. So, and I was back in the same estate. You know, so kind of just went back to that, the normal kind of thing that I was into.
Bloody, I'm going to go back to incident.
Yeah, sure. So. Yeah.
They're a great double act, aren't they? What I wanted to say to you, incident, a book is just amazing because it combines this kind of knowledge from below with actually really important theoretical insights. It's bouncing with political ideas and creativity. And I think there's quite a challenge there for an academic trying to survive in an academic world to actually deal with Brody yeah. and bring his perspective into the book. And you clearly formed a strong relationship. So how did you write Brody's? How did you manage to bridge that in some?
Yeah, I think... So, like I said earlier, I met you first at the trial in 2019, and it was just clear to me that I didn't want to write this book about this case that apparently made precedent in English law, right? It sort of created a new situation where drug dealers can now be prosecuted for modern slavery offences. And I didn't want to write about it without having heard his story. Mm-hmm. So I had to wait for years because... well, everyone refused me access to you. You know, the prison authorities wouldn't give me access. I couldn't get through to Glody's lawyers, his barristers. And then when he came out on license in 2023, we managed to meet.
Yeah.
And we formed a really close collaboration and friendship. And it was clear to me that having heard his story, and I guess you've only just started unpacking it, right? Like the audience doesn't know yet what, you know, how you got done for human trafficking and what that meant. But once I'd heard your story, it was clear to me that it had to be absolutely central to the book.
Yeah.
Because it's a story that wasn't ever heard by the legal system.
Yeah. Glody, it's not all been negative. Because since leaving prison, you've focused on mentoring and working with young adults. Yeah. You've got your own business, Go Fitness, and I think we might have a slide at some point so that everybody can connect to also Glody's podcast series. Why is the kind of support for young people that you're offering so important?
I think there's, when I started this, they wasn't enough people with lived experience that's actually been through the hard parts, the trauma, the prison, the whatever you want to call it, that are actually turning back around and giving back to the young people and saying to them, look, I've gone through this, I've been through this, so you guys don't have to. I felt like it was a very important role for me, especially I was in HMP ISIS, and what happened in ISIS was that they transitioned the prison back to a young offenders, and I was 26 and they changed it from 18 to 25, so they were transferring everyone over the age of 25 to adult prisons, but because I was local release, they kept me there. And what I saw in that time was 18-year-olds coming in from Cookinwood, Feltham, Aylesbury, Portland. They're coming into ISIS, and I'll be standing on the barrister, and it's literally a reflection of myself and the conversations they're having, the energy that they got. And it's literally reminding me of myself when I was 18. And I had to start thinking, like, I'm 26 now. If these guys don't break the cycle, they're going to also end up at 26 in prison. I was a fitness fanatic. I was training all day. I was doing burpees all day. Literally, officers would bust my door 12 o'clock, 4 o'clock, and I'm doing burpees, sweated out. They're like, do you ever sleep? You know? So I started taking my exercises into the exercise yard, and I started training. At first, I'm just training by myself. Then you get a one young person come up to me and say, bro, can I join you? I'm like, yeah, because I felt like certain conversations they were having, I couldn't join in because their conversation was still a bit young, street stuff, knife stuff, robberies, this and that. So then I said, yeah, you know, and that, yeah, turned into more people joining in. And then now I'm in my cell trying to get some sleep, and they're coming to my door like, yo, bro, we're working out today, tomorrow. But then I started to realize that this is actually good, because when we are working out together as a group in the exercise yard, nobody's fighting. No one's talking about gang, and everyone actually relaxes. People are talking about family issues. Like, they start saying, oh, I can't wait to go home. I want to see my daughter. You start hearing conversations that prisoners don't usually talk out loud amongst others, you know? So then the officers are always on to me, like, bro, do your mentoring course. And probably like a year later, I was like, I'm going to do my mentoring course. And I actually really, really enjoyed it. Like, I proper enjoyed it. And that's when I started just forming everything together in my soul. And I said, you know what, I'm going to come out, do my personal training course. I'm going to do mentoring and everything. And I thought, because I've got the lived experience, young people that are actually on the streets living it is going to relate to me. You know, I've been stabbed. I've been, you know, hit with at the back of the gun. I've been chased. I've been all sorts of things that I know young people are going through. I've been through it, you know, so why not help them change that cycle, you know?
We're going to bring in culture there. No pressure. How are we going to help them change that cycle? We actually want to shift the discussion a little bit so that we're looking from the top down now. We're looking at the state, because a lot of this book is about the state as well, and the state response. And I think the thing that Glody has just described, the things that young kids need around care and mentoring. It's just obviously not there with the state approach. So Kaju, how do policing and wider state practices shape the way black and working class youth are seen as criminals rather than people in need of care?
Yeah, thank you for that question. And thank you, Glady, for sharing your story. I think it crystallizes a lot of what the society we live in today and the criminalization that you went through. The context and the background behind that is, in my view, state-imposed poverty, right? The things that you had to survive and the conditions that you had to endure brought you to a place of vulnerability where you could be easily preyed upon. And that really, to take a big picture of this, is what an author, a writer who had his work published by Institute of Race Relations, Cedric Robinson, calls racial capitalism. This isn't a flavor of capitalism. It is saying that capitalism and racism are intrinsically linked. You can't separate the two things. And that means that capitalism requires there to be a racial hierarchy. Somebody has to be at the bottom. And we know through the transatlantic enslavement that Africans were designated that role. And that work, that ideology is renewed. It's not something that happens in the past. And we see policing, we see the state reproduce these things. And it does it in a way that blames the harms of society rather than on the structural factors that capitalism and the state produces, rather than those problems and those harms are something that we can recognize and attribute to the state. It individualizes it. It blames it on the individual. And say, actually, you're the reason why you got into trouble. You're the reason why you can't feed yourself. And so this is a logic of racial capitalism, right? It's a hierarchy that is imposed. And the way that the state operates, and I think this book explains this really well. It uses a term that's not, I guess, something that I would use. I wouldn't use techno-moral governance. But there's the terminology that I would use, and I think what helps explain this, and I'm going to write a bit more about this, but it's just really relabeling the work that INSA and others have done. It's moral laundering, right? Moral laundering. And there's a great thinker, Stuart Hall, wrote a book called Policing the Crisis. And what moral laundering essentially is the state realizing it's in a position of vulnerability, that's losing its legitimacy. And this was, Hall was talking about the 1970s when there was a lot of social upheaval. And in order to reassert its legitimacy, it creates a moral panic, right? And the moral panic of the time was the mugging crisis. Mugging wasn't an actual crime, but it was used a lot in the press to create this sense of crisis and urgency. And so that stage of moral panic, that then produces the need for law and order, i.e. more state violence. So the state creates vulnerability, creates this conditions of increasing poverty, whether through withdrawing public services or through increasing the ability of capitalism to exploit people. And then it creates a panic to say, look, well, as people are struggling, there's more crime. And the way to deal with this crime is to have more authoritarian power, more punishment. And to give a sort of example of this, it's kind of like if there's a problem, right? There's a crisis of people are falling off a cliff, right? How do you prevent it? The state's response is we'll put an ambulance at the bottom of the cliff and we'll help the people who fall off, right? The money goes into punishment. It goes into surveillance. It doesn't go into solving the problem of actually what's creating the vulnerability, what's creating the poverty that's pushing people into these conditions. Obviously, what we need is a fence to go at the top of a cliff. That is us putting care before cages. And I think that's what we need to be looking more into.
I don't know if in the audience that we have teachers, if we have doctors, if we have social workers, but I think one thing that's very important in the book is how INSA shows how those agencies then become an aspect of policing. They have to monitor young people's behaviour. They have to do risk assessments. And they're all doing it on the basis that we've got to protect these children from themselves. And then they're feeding into a policing system that actually puts a lot of pressure on young kids to act as informers. So, you know, I think there was one comment made by one kid in the book that really stuck with me. Well, there are two comments actually. County lines is like a job centre for the young, and the other is the logic is die or go to jail. So, insert, just take us through some of the safeguarding stuff and how that feeds into policing.
Yeah, okay. Because I think, so, Coach, just going back to what you said, you know, what we need is care, not punishment. And I guess in a way, that's the starting point of my book, because what the British state is now claiming to do is precisely to provide that care, right? So, you know, earlier when Liz asked me, how did I end up writing this book? I was saying I'd gone back to the community. I've been doing my long-term research and there, one of my collaborators was telling me about how the local kid was now treated as a victim in need of safeguarding and care, right? So you had the police actually using that very same language, right? Co-opting the language of care. And that sort of what this case showed me was actually a much broader national shift. So what's been happening in the UK over the last 10 years, 12 years, is that the British state has invented a whole new safeguarding agenda around drug dealers, or what it now calls county lines, county line drug dealing, claiming and asserting that what it's doing now is providing care, safeguarding these young people instead of punishing them. And the way in which the state claims it's doing that is by framing those young drug runners, like a young Glody, 15-year-old Glody, right, as victims of criminal exploitation and slavery or trafficking. That's the language that the state is doing, using now. And so as a consequence of that, you have all these safeguarding efforts being extended, not just by social services, but by the police now. The police now claim to be safeguarding agents, to be caring for communities, really. But you also have the flip side, where now the state is prosecuting these kids, not just for drugs offences anymore, but now also as human traffickers and slave masters. That's the flip side. And that's really the starting point of my book. You know, I'm sort of asking, what does it mean when the state co-opts the language of care? What happens when you actually extend more policing powers in the name of safeguarding, right? Like, who's actually being protected here and what are the effects?
Now, did you ever feel that you were being safeguarded as a child? Were there any good interactions with professionals?
Nah, to be honest with you, I never really had much contact with professionals apart from the police, you know. Even when I was homeless, like social services, my dad's report would be missing, you know, as a kid. The police used to call my phone, say, oh, just tell us you're all right, we'll leave you alone. That's what most I got. I didn't know any better either. You can answer the question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's you, Kojo. Unpick this safeguarding stuff, maybe take it to the next level, because what's very central to the policing narrative now, I've mentioned that Mark Riley is always saying very concerned about the lower life expectancy of young black kids because of knife crime, because of county lines. So they're trying to say that, you know, we're the good guys and we are enforcing the law in a colour neutral and even handed way, and that we're in some sort of kind of post-racial moment where the police have transcended their racism and they're neutral or even anti-racist. What's so difficult? Why is that narrative so hard to challenge?
Yeah, no, thank you for this question. And I think what, again, we're seeing, again, moral laundering at work, right? The state is co-opting this language of care, but the reality is that they're using these narratives to justify more violence, right? Whether it is these slave orders. And what we're seeing in this is the state is using these issues to sort of produce a liberal anti-racist narrative, right? And so just to sort of explain this a little bit, in case you don't not familiar with this, there are certain views, and racism is not like a universally accepted term. There are different views on racism. And one view, and I'll put a slide up on this later, but I won't go into it now. But one view is this idea of racism is essentially bad words and bad thoughts that exist in people's heads, right? So if you actually look at somebody, you know, somebody who is racialized, not as white, and your blood boils, then you're a racist. If you use bad words, then you're a racist. If you administer a state or a service that disproportionately affects or criminalizes or punishes groups that are divided by race or ethnicity, you're not a racist. So there's this distinction between liberal racism, which is the idea that racism is essentially people who say bad words, and then what radical versions of racism saying that actually racism is a system of violence. It's not what people individually believe or not. It is systems that produce violence and make certain groups vulnerable because of their ethnicity. And we live in a country where there is mass poverty. 22% of all children in England, I believe, are living in poverty. But when you look at it by ethnicity, 49% of black children, or 47% of black children, are living in poverty. Around 60% of Bangladeshi children are living in poverty. There is a racialized difference. And if we do not attack this idea that racism is just about bad words, then you will have the narrative that Nigel Farage is not racist. He's not racist. He's never said the N-word to me. And that is, or the opposite. Nigel Farage is definitely racist because when he was at school, he said some bad words. And that is the narrative. And so people can be working in the police service. They could be putting information into the gang's violence matrix. This was a database that the Metropolitan Police used to surveil largely black children. And then that system was used to disproportionately then target and criminalize these black children. And thanks to some people, some of these activists are in the room right now, challenged this. And the Metropolitan Police admitted, yeah, this is actually unlawful. We shouldn't be doing this. And they dismantled the gang's matrix because of the work of, as I say, some of the people in this room, the campaign erased the database. That work and that racism was clear. It was only brought as people challenged it, but the police were like, we're not racist. We just made a mistake. And this is the things that we need to challenge. But I'll stop because I know there's more questions to come.
Well, the book is called Drugs, Race and the Politics of Modern Slavery. So I think you need to come on to the modern slavery bit. And I know that INSA's big thing, the one thing she always goes, it's the law that puts the racism in the place. And again, it's not this, you know, narrative about bad people saying bad things. It's the law, it's the legislation. Could you just take us a little bit through this kind of weird situation we're in, where the whole discourse around what is slavery has now been turned around so that somebody like Glody becomes treated as though he was a slave master? Could you just take us briefly through the Modern Slavery Act?
Yeah, we were discussing statistics earlier, right? And I think you said
17,700 people had been referred to the National Referral Mechanism in 2024.
As victims, as modern slaves, right? So the British state has been recording this huge proliferation of so-called slaves, right? Which is a category I unpack in the book as well. But the official narrative we have is that we have a country full of slaves, trafficked children, right? Who need to be safeguarded. But that's only half of the story. The other half of the story is that, you know, where you have these so-called slaves or victims, you also have perpetrators, right? You have people who need to be prosecuted for actually enslaving or trafficking these children. And so this is this goes to the question you asked, Liz, can I put the law in? What happened is that a piece of legislation was enacted in 2015 called the Modern Slavery Act. And when that piece of legislation was enacted, Parliament didn't actually have the demographic of drug dealers in mind, right? They weren't thinking of people like Glody. In fact, Glody, you were in prison at that time, right? no one had identified you as a victim or slave. So this piece of legislation was passed primarily to deal with cross-border trafficking issues. But what happened is the same year that the Modern Slavery Act was enacted, the National Crime Agency discovered the so-called crisis of county lands, right? Sort of putting out a policing narrative. So this is based on police intelligence. It's not county lands. It's not a recorded offense. It's a policing narrative. So the National Crime Agency started putting out this narrative of drug dealers spreading from cities like London out into smaller towns and areas to deal drugs. And once that sort of crisis of county lines had been created in the public domain, what happened is that law enforcement on the ground, police officers, started thinking about how they could prosecute these drug dealers more effectively. Mm. And so they started talking the language of slavery and trafficking, right? It was law enforcement that brought in that language. So you needed slaves in order to prosecute, right? So then you have all these slaves being entered into the national referral mechanism, all these children who are being exploited. And at the same time, you have police forces starting to investigate for human trafficking offenses. And this is what happened. So a piece of legislation that was designed in a very different context came to be applied and used to prosecute and convict drug dealers, essentially as slave masters, as human traffickers. And Glody's case was the test case, case that the Crown prosecution brought to see if it could get away with doing that. Yeah. And it could. He was convicted.
And Glody, you put up your hands to a drug dealing, but you said you rejected the label of trafficker and slave master.
In 2014, I was in my bed at 4 a.m. My house got kicked into in Tottenham. And I thought, oh, the game's up. You know, I got every sort of paraphernalia in the house that relates to drugs. You know, I got 20-ton presses. I got mixing bowls. I got everything from weights to everything. So when the police came through that door, I was like, you got me, you know? And then the detective came through and said, we're arresting you for human trafficking. And I said, what? I said, I ain't brought no one into the country. Like, what are you talking about? And they're like, no, man, it's a new law and we're arresting you for it. And I was mixed with confusion, you know? I was determined that they had the wrong guy, you know? All the way down to Lewisham Police Station, I'm singing in the undercover car. You guys got the wrong guy. Like, this is so funny, whatever. And then in the interview, they never even mentioned it. They never mentioned human trafficking once. They only dealt with the drugs case. And being caught with what I got caught with, I went guilty for the drugs, you know. I was given 6 years for that. And I done my time. But 6 months before I got released, they came back again and they said, we're charging you for human trafficking before my release date. And I said, why? What's happened? What's changed? Nothing's changed since I've been arrested in 2014. And they said, basically, there was a drugs phone that I was answering. And on that drugs phone, there was workers on the phone. On that phone, I was 20 at the time. On that phone, there was a young person who was age 17. He would get a train to Portsmouth and back to deliver the drugs, to pick up the money, vice versa. So the police said, because I gave that young person money to get on the train, then I've trafficked him. And I said, you know, I'm from Congo, innit? Like, I know what you guys done to my country. You know, I haven't trafficked anyone. And they won the conviction and I became a slave master.
And so did you?
Yeah, I was just going to maybe explain how the prosecution constructed the case, just for context. So, Glody, you were charged alongside two other people, right? They're two co-defendants. The prosecution's case was that Glody and his two co-defendants had trafficked 6 children, teenagers plus 1 vulnerable adult from London to Portsmouth.
Yeah.
And legally speaking, what they had to prove is that you had arranged or facilitated the travel of the so-called victims with a view to exploiting them. And I think there were three things that stood out in the way that the prosecution constructed the case. One, the prosecution never accepted Glody's version of the story, which is that you were one of many people in a drugs business, right? The prosecution really started from the premise that because Glody was holding the phone, right? Like yeah. The drug users were calling the phone that you were in control of at that point, and you were then passing those drug orders on to others who were delivering the drugs on the ground. The prosecution said he had risen to the top of the drugs business, right? Glody was in control of a drugs empire. That was the first point. The second point is that actually none of the child victims had been willing to act as witnesses for the prosecution. So there were no child slaves in the trial actually speaking up. Because a lot of them had already been convicted for drugs offenses, right? And then yeah. The prosecution turned around and said, actually, you guys were victims. Can you please testify? Can you please be witnesses in court? And the third point I think that's relevant is that the evidence that prosecution relied on to construct Glody's case of trafficking was based on phone schedule data, yeah. Right? So-called CDR records, call data records that had been extracted from mobile phone companies. What did this data show? There wasn't a single, like, no content, no actual text message or phone exchange. Instead, what this data shows is the pattern of communication. The data can show, oh, you know, the phone that was attributed to Glody called a drugs runner's phone 200 times, 300 times, 400 times in 3, 4, 5 days, right? So what it can prove is a pattern of communication. And also what it can prove is the movement of these phones. You can use co-location devices to show that the phones traveled from London to Portsmouth. Yeah. And that was the evidence. It worked.
Yeah, it definitely worked. I was a bit hurt at the time of my conviction. I'm not going to lie. I was hurt because I didn't understand why I was being convicted for human trafficking. There was like, sorry, when I talk about it, it takes me back to that time when I was going through it. But I never actually understood why I was being convicted for what I was getting convicted for. You got to remember, I was selling drugs from a young age myself, you know, and there was drug dealers before I even came to this country, you know. So, when I'm saying in front of the police and they're adamant that I'm trafficking these young people, I was thinking, so what about me when I was selling drugs at 16, when you guys gave me 3 years? It hurt me a lot, but then I educated myself and, you know, I told myself and I just used it to help other people. And this is why I'm sitting here today to show young people from the hood, from the estate, from the blocks, that one, you can change your life, you know, and two, just be mindful what you guys are doing out there, because what could seem as easy drug dealing or with your friends, you could end up being labeled as a slave master.
I've been given the job to get a train to the station on time, which is to leave enough time for questions. But I want to just give the last word to Kojo, and I think you've had a nice pass there from Glody, the pass of the ball, because the last question is, how can we work through the issues here and do it from an abolitionist perspective?
Yeah, thank you. So I'm going to ask for that slide to come back up, because we've talked about these two frameworks, right? These contested racism. And also briefly talked about moral laundering, right? This stage process of there being a state-induced panic because to distract from the legitimacy that the state is facing because it's not providing for people. It's presiding over worsening social conditions. And then the second thing is that it then has to create this demand for more law and order to position itself as like a moral sort of savior, as doing good by responding to this confected crisis. And then as it then implements and introduces this violence, it's justified. It's making what is dirty violence seem clean, seems a moral good, that it's absolutely right that we take young black men and make them appear to be analogous to Edward Colston. Like the people who actually trafficked actual African slaves. So this is the moral laundering And like for us to understand and to break that from an abolitionist perspective, we need to have our definitions right of what racism really is and what is an anti-racist framework that can get us out of this mess. And abolitionism, to give it a clearer idea, what racism is, and there's a very jargonistic, but it's a great definition by Ruth Wilson Gilmore. Again, racism is racialized systems of violence. You can objectively measure that. You can't necessarily measure objectively what is in someone's head. And so what we need to target is not what people think, but what the systems produce and actually do. So the policies that actually create these differentiated racialized outcomes, whether it is in poverty, whether it is in criminalization or elsewhere. And then how do we actually correct this? Well, we need to focus on ending these systems of violence, right? And actually analyze these outcomes because they are objective. Why is it almost half of the youth prison population are black or mixed race black? Those are things that we need to produce. And it's linked directly. We know it's not a mystery, right? There's lots of research to show that where is the prevalence of poverty, there is the prevalence of criminalized behavior, right? We know that there is much more stop and search happening in the streets of Peckham and Croydon than in Richmond upon Thames. And there is, and that is a racist outcome. But the state would have you think it's not, that it's morally justified. So we are organizing, as in Black Lives Matter UK and others. There's a new organization called Harm to Healing that I would encourage you also to look up. And you can get involved in how we develop systems of care against these systems of violence. I'll leave it there.
Yeah. Perhaps if I can just add, it was interesting that you use Richmond as an example, because there might be proportionately fewer stops and searches in Richmond, but if you're black in Richmond, you're going to be stopped more than if you're black in Peckham, actually.
Right.
So, and I think one thing also, which INSA does in the book, and there's not been enough time to talk about, is to recognise the way in which Britain has, in many ways, particularly, well, England and Wales, has embraced modern slavery legislation without engaging at all with with Britain's imperial past. So somehow slavery's just been repackaged in a way, in a very convenient, and you use the word co-opting. But it's interesting, isn't it, that actually we can't, it's not possible to talk about the legacies of slavery, which is some of the things that you were talking about, and also the kind of political implications of those histories. And when you talk about the kind of funding and the austerity policies and all of that, I mean, I think even this surprised me, but it was only in, I think, 2015 that the government stopped the compensation for former slaves.
We paid off the debt.
This is 2015, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So Britain, very briefly, for those of you who don't know, the 1833 Act, which abolished slavery, the only way it got through was that they had to pay compensation. It's like, this is a great harm that we've caused. So we need to compensate the enslavers for loss of property. Right. That's what they did. And it was about 40% of the UK economy at the time. So to pay off these enslaved people, £20 million in the money back then. And that debt, because the government couldn't afford to pay 40% of its entire revenue in 1 year. So that was borrowed money. If you have worked in up until the year 2015, you contributed to paying off that debt. And the government boasted, hey, you helped end slavery by paying your taxes. In 2015, we ended, we've paid off the debt. But that was to the people who profited off enslavement, not the people who suffered it. And yeah, that's again, moral laundering at its finest.
We probably need to wrap up now and hand over to all of you. So we have 25 minutes or so for questions, both from people that are online and also people here. Please, if you can state your name and your affiliation, we're opening the floor for questions or comments, ideally questions.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ ask social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
So there's some, I can see a hand, but not who it's attached to.
It's frightening.
Hi, my name is Adi. I'm from SOAS. I'm sort of interested in carceral labor. So like prison labor, was that ever used to sort of discipline you while you were inside of the system? And I also sort of want to push back on the different types of racism. While I agree that moral laundering is very much being done here in Britain, I think individualized racism is what re-perpetuates the system. So those two things sort of work hand in hand. And my third question is, what are like effective crime prevention policies or like poverty prevention policies? Because that's how you sort of like end mass imprisonment, right? So yeah, I want your thoughts on that. Thank you.
I believe your first question was about labor in prison and what was that like? I mean, labor in prison, it really depends on if you're convicted or remanded, you know. If you're a remanded prisoner, which means you haven't been sentenced yet or convicted, you have a lot more leeway in terms of the work you need to do. You know, you can wake up and say, I don't want to go to work. You might not get punished. You could lay in your bed all day if you want and nothing's going to happen to you. But if you're convicted and you're sentenced or you're recalled, you have to work, you know, and work in prison and education in prison, it's very minimal. Education is like a primary school, early secondary school type education, maths, English, that kind of stuff, you know. Labor is more packing tea bags, you know. It's not work that's really going to make you think, I want to come out of prison and become a better person, you know. They got you putting cereal in a bag all day. And that's your job, you know, maybe putting a few things on pedal bikes, and that's your job. Obviously, I've been through loads of prisons, you know, England and Scotland. So each prison is different. So I can't speak for all prisons, but the incentive is there for you to work. If you work, you get the benefits, right? You get your enhanced, you get more money to spend, you get extra visits a month. You know, so people want to work. But if you don't work, you might get a nicking, you might not. You might get a red entry, you might not. You know, it's hit and miss. You know, they might leave you in your cell for a whole week and no one asks you why you're not going to work. It varies different prisons. So I don't know if I can answer that question or if I've answered it.
Yeah. Do you want to come back on the question on racism?
Yeah. So on, I think the questioner was essentially saying, you need to have individualized racism for structural racism to exist, right? And obviously there's some truth in that in terms of like you've got your Elon Musks of this world who is openly like, let's bring back global apartheid. But you don't actually have to have those Elon Musks of the world for violence to perpetuate, right? You can have people who absolutely, and we've got history of people in the Gold Coast marrying black women and yet selling their sisters or siblings across, right? So there isn't that necessarily hatred in the way that individual liberal racists or people who advocate liberal racism would like us to believe. And I think it's really important to distinguish that you can run a system with having no ideological like investment in it. Right. And this is what I'm kind of wanting us to think through, that you can actually be, there's a lot of home office civil servants who right now are working on the Windrush compensation scheme. And there's a petition that I'm going to ask to put back on here. Right. These people are of all backgrounds. They think they are trying to do good work, i.e. we're trying to give the people who were harmed by the ongoing hostile environment, we're trying to give them compensation. that system, that compensation scheme is designed to fail. It's designed to fail. They're not getting legal support to actually put their application forward. And that's resulted in over more than 50% of everyone who has claimed compensation under the Windrush compensation scandal have been refused any payment. Right? And 10,000 people have applied. So they are contributing to racist outcomes, but they've got no personal investment in it. And I think if we have to make this claim that you have to be absolutely committed to racism to manage racist systems, then we actually lose the point of what capitalism is. We can all be invested in capitalism without being capitalists, right? Without thinking it's a great idea. But the system perpetuates because that's how it's designed. And I think that's what I'm trying to get at. Not that there are no actual racists who hate black people and others, of course there are. But that is not the engine of the system. The engine of the system is actually to produce profit. And to produce profit, you need disposable people. And for the system to continue in its form, it has to shift the blame of the system onto those disposable populations. That's what I mean. And that is what we're trying to undo when we advocate abolition.
Thank you. Somebody in the middle with a sheet. Bead bracelet. I think. We get the mic.
Hi, I'm Chris Navy. Well, I suppose it's something else. I'm part of the LMUK. Pardon? Oh, yeah, naturally. Thank you so much for your time. What I was thinking about when you guys were talking about the specific years, like in 2016, I was thinking about a time that I was in school and actually there was like an influx of police officers coming to the school trying to educate people or spread awareness on how you could be involved in county lines and the like signs of that. Like if someone offers you to like, I can pay for your trainers, like kind of think, oh, I can buy you like chicken and chips, like things like that. And actually you guys speaking has made me think like, oh, where did that come from? Especially because I went to a predominantly black school. So I just wanted to ask, yeah, in terms of like the after like being part of that research, like the reflections of that, like how do you feel like that's kind of perpetuated now in those schools or through the state, if that makes sense?
So can you just say that last bit again to your question?
How, I guess, experiences like that or the way that, like, the police have, like, entered those kind of different environments, like actually speaking to young people that could possibly be, quote-unquote, victims and how that, like, how that links, I guess, to everything that you've kind of discussed or the research in your book.
The police didn't say
it's being embedded in schools.
Yeah, so how the police is becoming embedded in schools and what the effects of that are.
Yeah,
I think this is so, I write about that a lot in my book, what it actually means for the police to become a primary carer, right, to take on safeguarding functions, which is a contradiction in terms. Like we have the British police today saying that they're safeguarding thousands and thousands of people, right? And sort of in that process also embedding itself in schools, sharing data with social services, housing authorities, all sorts of other institutions that historically have taken on more caring roles, right? And what I'm trying to describe in the book is just the very pernicious outcomes that that has, right? Once the police embeds itself in schools, cooperates with social services and all these other institutions, once that data is shared, what you're doing is you're extending the scope of policing into all these other areas. You know, preemptive policing is becoming ever more embedded. You don't need to have any crimes committed for there to be police, because the police is there to perform a preventive role, right? To be there even before or where potentially no crime will ever happen. And that, I mean, at least that's what I argue in the book, is a very dangerous move because you're securitizing essentially vulnerability where no crime has been committed.
And so what I think you do in the book so well, so frighteningly, is show how the teacher then becomes the police officer and how the teacher is encouraged to have this classificatory knowledge and actually are almost like instructed to be very, very aware and are making judgments about personal relationships. So I thought maybe fish that out a bit more as well.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I will. But sorry, I just want to say one other thing, which is that this, what I've just described, is not new, right? This is what the police have already been doing and when it was doing anti-gangs policing stuff, right? But what I think is so pernicious about what's happening today is that now it's done in the language of safeguarding, of extending victimhood, right? The police is no longer interested in prosecuting. Now it's protecting young people, but it's essentially embedding and using exactly those tools that have been tried and tested in anti-gangs and anti-terrorism policing for a long time. And your question was more about
the teacher's role in measuring risk and vulnerability.
Yeah. I think one of the, again, what's so difficult and potentially problematic with county lines policing is because of how it's been constructed as being all about exploitation, right? But exploitation is this thing that what is it even where the criminal law defines what exploitation is, it, by its nature, becomes an individualized crime between a victim and a perpetrator. It's not a structural problem, it's an individualized problem. But how do you prove the crime of exploitation? What does that look like? And what I describe a lot in the book is how, because it's so difficult, right, to talk about exploitation or slavery in a world where slavery, transatlantic slavery, has been legally abolished, professionals sort of fall back onto discretionary assessments. They fall back onto personal biases, right? They use things like a person's age, their gender, their ethnicity, their alleged membership in gangs, their previous offending histories. All these things are used as proxies to determine whether exploitation or slavery has happened. And that's a very dangerous move because we're not talking about legal categories. We're not talking about crime statistics. We're talking about personal discretionary assessments that school teachers, police officers, social workers are now undertaking on a daily basis.
Yeah, there's a bit in the book where you talk about a youth worker who talks to a particular young person, and through that vague conversation, they make the decision that this person is not at greater risk, and it's incredibly subjective. The point that I wanted to sort of add is that, yeah, this is not new. We see this in PREVENT, right? Mm-hmm. The PREVENT program. Mm-hmm. These, again, are systems of racialization, of designating people as suspect populations, and then training NHS staff, teachers, to identify this by teaching them literally racist tropes. It's like, oh, are they praying a lot? Now you should report that. And that creates the absurdity of children who misspell cucumber as cook bomb being then referred to the PREVENT program, not because they are a white kid writing that, but precisely because they are racialized as other. These are the systems of racism that the state has to renew, has to reproduce. It's not something that exists in the past. It's something that's being created because this is what capitalism requires, racial capitalism requires.
Thank you. So right at the very back, navy blue.
Hi, my name is Ayushman, and I have a question for INSA. For the last 35 years, criticalist scholars have clearly established that modern slavery, human trafficking, these are very, very conservative, like protectionist thing, which is designed to harm people. Yeah. And it is really not meant for survival. It basically allows 500 different types of politics to unfold. Yeah. But the discourse is thriving. Yeah. Discourse is not only a lot of countries, they are passing their Modern Slavery Act, yada, yada, yada. And I feel that it is perhaps because of maybe critical scholars, because we have a parasitical relationship with the discourse. Yeah. Because whatever we say as a critical scholar is easily co-opted by the dominant paradigm, by police, by the state. Yeah. So do you see, you know, risk of similar thing happening in your book as well? You are talking about some issues. You are like, you know, suggesting some stuff. Do you think that it could easily be co-opted by the state, and you know, the whole paradigm will flourish?
Yeah, that's a good question. Can my work be co-opted by the state? Of course it can. Yeah. 100%. I mean, the sort of process of co-optation that I unpack in the book is what Coretta mentioned at the end of our conversation, which is how the language of slavery itself, right, has been co-opted and weaponized as a political and legal tool. And I think it is really significant to just highlight here that, you know, Glody was convicted as the first ever slave master in a drugs trial the year before Black Lives Matter took to the streets, right, to talk about the legacies of transatlantic slavery, to talk a very different language of exploitation and trafficking and slavery, right? So that process of co-optation is happening in politics, as you've pointed out, and it's becoming legally and juridically enshrined. You know, and we're seeing more of this happening, more. It's not like the government is rolling back on its modern slavery legislation. As you say, you know, globally, we see more anti-trafficking legislation being enacted also in the UK right now. It's being further codified. And of course, yeah, any kind of academic output can be co-opted in that process as well. I see it as part of this broader logic of political co-optation, and our scholarship can be one part of that. Yeah.
Perhaps also just if I could add a point, which is crime and victimization is the classic example around which we can generate fear. So who wouldn't be against trying to prevent exploitation and violence? I mean, that's what makes crime and the kind of the pursuit of social ordering in society such a ready vessel in which you can do all of this, because it's so hard to, like, who's not going to be against victimization of young people? And of course the challenge is always who will be held responsible. And I think one of the first things that you said, Liz, was that this is all very familiar. There are so many ways in which we can recognize the ways in which this legislation has been used in particular ways, but we have literally decades of examples of across almost every sphere of social policy in which we can see the way in which welfare operates in deeply racialized ways. So I think the point about familiarity is actually quite an important one, because we're not willing to recognize some of the kind of familiar emblems of slavery and Britain's kind of culpability, but we're very quick to then be able to kind of engineer ways in which we can use all kinds of legislation in very familiar ways. And ultimately, it's also about who those young people are that are readily available to be compromised and co-opted by all of this legislation. And more often than not, it's young Black and brown people. I mean, it's quite straightforwardly the same people who are vulnerable to these kinds of abuses of state power. And I think it was helpful to talk about that as being about, I think you use the term state violence. Perhaps if we can take our question from Deep Online.
Do you have two late questions
online? This is fine. Yeah, it's online. We got two linked questions online, so I'll just read out them both. The first is from Sheila Semoff from Cheshire West and Chester Council, who asks, does the panel think that the statutory responsibility put on local authorities to do an NRM referral for under 18s has contributed to the problems discussed today? And the second is from Kate Bond, who asks, it's probably intentionally made very challenging for people working to support young people on the front line to not become complicit in some of the system's harm by being part of it. What work needs to be done to support frontline staff to engage in action to challenge and dismantle harmful aspects of the system and participate in political education and collective action?
Sorry, can you just paraphrase the questions for us again? Summarize and paraphrase quickly.
The first one is about local authorities having to do an NRM referral and whether that contributes to the issues that are being discussed. Yeah. And the second one is about how to support frontline staff to challenge and dismantle the system.
Yeah, so I'll take the first question. So, you know, these frontline officials who actually enter people into the NRM mechanism, which is the official state body that takes decisions on whether a person is a victim of slavery or trafficking, right? And the question is, if you're entering young people or anyone into the system, are you complicit with the harm, right, that we've outlined here? And I think it's a really tricky question. And I think there's two ways of going about it. I think if we're just talking about defensive strategies, as in like, how can we work with the system that we've got, as opposed to imagine a completely new system, which is what, you know, you were talking about, Koja. If we're working defensively, working with the tools that we have, then I think absolutely, you know, submit as many young people or individuals as you can into the NRM. If we can expand the scope of legal victimhood, right, and get people recognized as victims as opposed to offenders, that's a good thing. But that's working with the tools of the system, right? It's sort of perpetuating the binary of victim and offenders that we're trying to break down here. So I think the bigger question here is, if we don't just want to do defensive work, right, where we're always just working with the system, we have to think politically. We have to think much bigger, right? And there the question is, how can we actually have campaigns that get to the structural, like what you were talking about, the structural roots of why young people end up in the illicit economy in the first place? How do we address on a structural level the interpersonal harm that's being committed, right? And those are very different questions from the sort of more defensive ways of working with the system. I think the two need to coexist. You know, you can on the one hand perpetuate the system, but try and create loopholes or expand, as I said, the scope of victimhood, while at the same time always holding the space where you campaign and work towards structural change.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. I just want to quickly also interject on the actual NRM itself, right? And does that create demand for effectively more policing, more of these sort of authoritarian powers? Yes, it does, of course. Does that mean you should not refer people who are vulnerable? I don't think you should. In terms of harm reduction, sometimes the problem with the state is that it's both our abuser and our protector, right? There isn't a clean relationship that you can have with the state or capitalism, because we're all enmeshed in it. We're all complicit in perpetuating it to some degree, obviously some much more than others. But in terms of, actually the mechanism of NRM, we talked about this number, 17,000 people, I think in up till the end of 2024, who were referred to it. In terms of the actual convictions that have been made, it's 0.3%. That's how much enforcement is actually happening as a result of this. That kind of, not that I'm for high numbers of convictions, actually I'm not, but it shows you how serious the state actually takes this, that it's more about propaganda than actual rooting out the problem of supposed modern slavery. And when we hear arguments for the state needs to do much more violence, we need to send people to Rwanda, we need to strip people of their jewelry if they come up here on a boat, these are arguments for increased violence. And what we need to do in terms of campaigning, I would encourage people, again, not only to get involved with Harm to Healing, but Black Lives Matter UK, we run political education programs. It's called Timbuktu, and you can check it on our website. The thing that was on the board earlier is that we also need to actually just resist the systems that we're in ways that we can. Be creative. Don't think there is one way of solving it. We can subvert and use the system against it. And one of the things that we're trying to do is this reset the Windrush compensation scheme because of the problems that I outlined earlier, but I'll stop.
Liz, I don't know if you want to say anything about the work that you do, because you will have confronted that question of what's the best way to act and to resist and to respond.
Put you on the spot there, haven't you? I was just concentrating on getting the training and letting them do all the hard work.
Maybe just say a bit about what the IRR does.
Well, I can do that. I honestly feel that we just need to have a revolution. we've just, this society has just gone backwards so fast, so quickly. You know, somebody asked a question about poverty reduction and I was sitting here, can we have a social safety net? Can we have a welfare state back again? We really have to go right back to basics and start again. And I guess that's what we try to do at the Institute. We have a news service, RRR News. We have our journal, Race and Class, which is more scholarly. But we're just trying to help people think outside the box and, yeah, get the kind of discussions going that we really need to have. So, yeah, please sign up to RRR News and keep in touch with the Institute. And, yeah, just it's great for us through our work to meet people like IMSA and people like Kojo and Glody and you, Greta. Thank you.
Great. We've probably got time for just one last question. So, person with the hat.
Nathan, Howard League. I was first arrested when I was 15, operating a county line. And throughout that whole prosecution process, not once was modern slavery offered as a defence. I think the language they used at the time was duress, which is a much higher legal bar. In years later, when I was charged as an adult with supplying drugs, my defence solicitor immediately offered the defence of modern slavery. And, you know, I felt that they would be happy to coach me through that option if I decided to take it to trial. So I suppose my question to the panel is this. You spoke a lot about the prosecution side of things, the police, the CPS. What about the role of the defence, the police station reps and the solicitors?
Thank you.
I guess I'll answer that question. Yeah, we didn't talk about defence at all, actually, but in the book, a large chunk of the book is about the defence lawyers in court. So we did mention this, but the Modern Slavery Act that provides prosecution tools to prosecute people like Bodhi for human trafficking offences, it also provides a defence, the so-called Section 45 exploitation defence, which you can run for certain offences. Basically, it says that if you've committed a crime, certain crimes like drug dealing as a consequence of your exploitation or being trafficked, you can be acquitted for that crime. And I worked a lot with defense lawyers for this research. You know, I went with them to the trials. I was in back offices working with them. And what I saw is that they struggle, at least in the first few years. Maybe now that the courts are more used to this language of modern slavery, it's easier to run the defense. But definitely in the first few years, it was so difficult because, yes, the law has made a technical tool available to run this defense, almost like the defense of duress, right? You can acquit a criminal. But in practice, if the courts continue to think of young men or boys like Glody as drug dealers, as criminals, right? How are you going to run that defense? The judge is not going to buy it. The jury isn't going to acquit people like Glody. So what I found as I was following these trials is that so often, prosecution and judges, the court falls back onto old kind of racializing gangs narratives. Oh, but look at that person. They do drill, you know, they make drill music. Look at that person. They have funny nicknames. I'm sure that's a gang name. You know, look at their previous offending history. They've committed drugs offenses again and again and again. Of course, they're criminal, right? So there are all these ways in which prosecution or the courtroom can bring in this so-called evidence to make someone running the Section 45 defence look guilty.
Mm.
Yeah.
I think we probably need to wrap up now. Oh, yes. We're at the end of the book launch. Thank you. So please join me in thanking our panelists.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favourite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.